Thank you very much, and welcome to another bout of competitive philology, etymology, and codology between our sprightly teams, Dilys Powell and Frank Muir. And Antonia Fraser and Dennis Norton. And we start, as always, by trying to slake our perpetual thirst for meaning. Frank, what's the meaning of tushery, T-U-S-H-E-R-Y.
It was coined to describe the kind of restoration dialogue, rather overdone. Oh, tush and fie, Lady Birdworthy, a pox on me wig, la.
That's exactly it. That's exactly
it. You're a froward hussy.
Yeah. It's too marks of that.
Tushery.
Yes, it's a literary usage of such archaisms as tush, pish, zounds, etc. Antonia, what is a paradigm, P-A-R-A-D-I-G-M?
Oh, I knew this once.
Apparently it's used so often wrongly.
Yes.
That I have no confidence anymore in what it really means. But it's a kind of set of limiting factors or perimeters.
It's much simpler than that. I mean, I use it wrongly and will not from this day forth because I looked it up in the dictionary today.
What a kind of... it's a story, then.
It's. I will give you a mark because you're nearly there. It's an example or pattern, but especially of the inflection of a noun or a verb, and I didn't know that it was related to inflection. Anyway, that is what a paradigm is. Dilys, what's the meaning of quondam? Q-U-O-N-D-A-M. Quondam.
I think it means formerly. Something which you used to have a job and you haven't got it now. You're a quondam, whatever it is. Is that right?
You think two clear marks. Well done. It's a former holder of some office or position, a jack out of office, in fact. But it can be a quondam schoolfellow, something like that. Anyway, two marks to Dilys. Dennis, what is the meaning of to gerbil? J-I-R-B-L-E. Not the animal. To gerbil. A verb. J-I-R-B-L-E.
Sounds like one of those made-up words. The animal would be, if you made the animal into a verb, to gerbil, it'd be very good for what babies do. You know that stage they go through with their food where you have to do that one for mummy, one, and they store it in a pouch in their and you can't get it down like a gerbil. That, it sounds like it's to gerbil, like to jabber and gibber, and is it of that family?
No, it's it would be... There's an old music hall joke about, do you drink a lot? No, I gerbil most of it.
I spill most of it.
Yes.
Yes? Is that what it means, to spill?
Yes, it is. It's to spill a liquid by unsteady movement of the vessel. Now, before we go on to the next round, here, Frank and Dennis, are the quotations you've been given for the last round. And yours, Frank, is Mene, Mene, Tekel, Apasin, which is the original writing on the wall from Belshazzar's feast. And Dennis's is Hoist with his own petard, a quotation from Hamlet. Now, a round entitled Who is He? From the following quotations, can you identify the gentleman who's referred to and the name of the poet?
A mark. Disraeli.
Minus one. Frank. Here's the quotation. And still they gazed, and still the wonder grew that one small head could carry all he knew.
Is it Deserted Village?
Yes, it
Oliver
is.
Oliver Goldsmith.
Mm. Who do you think? Which of them is it?
The loud laugh that spoke the vacant mind. It's either the school teacher or the parson.
Yes, and it's more likely to be the second. So it's more likely to be the second.
In fact, it is the second. it is the parson.
Two marks to Frank. And the poet.
Poet was Noel, Oliver Goldsmith. Yes. Lovely poems. Yes.
Antonio, here's your quotation. He felt the cheering power of spring. It made him whistle, it made him sing.
It's not very good, is it?
No, he specialises in the not very good. I didn't really give it the full fling that it needs.
Is it McGonagall or one of
them? No, I think he's in the same league.
Alfred Austin? Or...
And then they knew the perilous rock and something the bishop of, or the abbot of Aberbrothrock. There's a line in that
something rock. What's it? That,
yes.
That awful part.
Inchcape. The Inchcape rock, yes. Yeah.
That's
Southey, wasn't it? Isn't it?
Yes, Southey. Yeah. Southey, yeah. One mark so far.
Sir Ralph Royster. It isn't there, Ralph Royster, Sir Royster Ralph, but it's like that.
Sir Ralph the something tore his hair, he cursed himself in his despair.
Oh, it's like Billy Bennett, isn't it?
Oh, we'll give you one and a half and put you out of your... Yeah. Sir Ralph the Rover.
The Rover.
People may love Southey. I just think... Yeah. I mean, he was great for reciting at school, and even then we made fun of him.
He was a very, very nice man, and a wonderful writer, but not of poetry.
Oh, you're just putting me in my place, Frank, quite rightly. Dillis, your quotation, a sadder and a wiser man, he rose the morrow morn.
It's courage.
Yes, indeed.
It's the end of the Ancient Mariner.
And... Therefore,
the person who is a sadder and a wiser man is the wedding guest, because he never got to the wedding, did he?
Probably the bride.
Yes, I don't think it was. Yes, but in fact, in the poem, I think the sadder and the wiser man is the mariner, isn't it?
Oh, is it?
I think
he didn't rise. The mariner didn't rise the morrow morn.
No, I think Dillis is right.
No, actually,
really.
You are right. You
really
are right. Two marks, right. Three marks for Dillis. It is the very end, isn't it?
Yes, it's the last line.
He passeth one of three.
Yes, yes. Like one that is forlorn, sad and a wiser man. He rose the morrow morn.
Absolutely right.
Oh. Dennis,
didn't he?
Dennis.
Sorry.
Dennis, your quotation. He was a man, take him for all in all, I shall not look upon his like again.
That was Hamlet talking about his father.
Yes, Hamlet's dad, written by... Two marks for Dennis. I tried to fracture it as I read it, but it's very difficult to fracture it. Now, a round of improbable confrontations. You've got to imagine you're being introduced to some historical characters, and I want you to think of an opening sentence or phrase with which you would start up a conversation with them to try and get an easy flow of conversation. I'll give you each, to give you time to think, I'll tell you who you're going to meet and then introduce you. Frank, you're going to meet Florence Nightingale. And you have to think of your opening phrase or sentence to start the flow of conversation. Antonia, you're going to meet Attila the Hun. Dillis, you're going to meet Guy Fawkes. And Dennis, you're going to meet Signora Lucretia Borgia. So what we want from you now is your opening sentence of phrase when I perform the introduction. And I perform the introduction for Frank, Miss Florence Nightingale, Mr. Frank Muir.
Miss Nightingale, you've done so much in rousing public interest in the nursing profession. Didn't I hear you in Berkeley Square?
Now, Antonia, your introduction is Lady Antonia... Attila the Hun.
Well, I'm so glad to meet you, Mr. Attila, or should it be Mr. Hun? Because I'm sure we share a common interest in the abolition of capital punishment. And I wonder if I could persuade you to come along to some of my meetings, preferably leaving your hordes behind.
I think that will do very nicely. Now, Dilys, your introduction. Miss Dilys Powell, Mr. Guy Fawkes.
I am glad you're here. The children will be delighted. You brought the most wonderful weather for the fireworks.
Dennis, your introduction. Signora Lucretia Borgia, Mr. Dennis Norden.
Assuming there was a bar nearby, one could say, Madam Borgia, name your poison.
And now, a round of ancient adjectives which over the years have changed their meaning. And what I'm after is the original meaning of these adjectives. And Frank, yours is the adjective naughty.
Oh.
What did it originally mean?
Good deed in a naughty world. Yeah. Originally, a good deed in a naughty world meant an evil world, didn't it?
But before that, yes, but before that meaning...
Naughty means worthless, doesn't it?
Yes.
Originally. Then it meant nasty.
Mm. So the original...
Evil.
So you've got your two marks because your first meaning... having or possessing naught, in fact. Antonia, the original meaning of silly...
Oh, silly meant simple, didn't it?
Yes.
The silly sheep.
But before that, it meant something more worthwhile than simple.
Pure?
Yes, getting very near to move along that direction.
Pure seems to be absolute. I don't know how you're being pure.
Well, if you are pure, you are also...
Holy.
Holy, blessed, innocent. Two marks, anyway, you've got there. I had great fun. One of the nicer objects in my house is a book I got from my father, which is Johnson's Dictionary. This one was published in 1786, so I looked these words up. His first meaning, Johnson's first meaning, is harmless, innocent, artless. So it was beginning to move along then. Dilys, the original meaning of enthusiastic...
I think it had a religious meaning.
Yes, it did.
Didn't it?
Yes.
I think at the time of, I don't know, about the 18th century, it meant enthusiastically religious, didn't it?
Yes.
And before that, in classical times it has another meaning. I think
even in Johnson, yes, Frank, that your friend is going
possessed.
To whisper to you.
Possessed.
Yes.
Oh, possessed by religious beliefs.
Yes, by God. That's two marks to do it. My Johnson's dictionary, his first meaning is possessed of some communication with the deity. Wow. So it has moved along. Dennis, what was the original meaning of prestigious? Which these days is an adjective applied to try to make things impressive that you can't think of anything else impressive about them.
Something so call them quite different it was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Candy-striped, it originally meant, no? Or lamppost-shaped.
Pressure cook.
Yeah.
With your initials printed upon it.
Yeah.
No, it's quite different, but it's... think about the prestige bit.
Oh, is it prestige digitated? It means be able to do card tricks.
Yes. Which allowed you, if you could do card tricks,
you get in anywhere, yes. you could all the parties.
But apart from entertaining people, if you did card tricks in games, for instance, you could...
Cheat?
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
Cheating?
So, yes, it's getting... Oh, two marks, I think, where we can't push you. It's really meant deceitful or deceptive by the practice of juggling, in fact. So now we move on to the last round and Frank and Dennis's quotations. And Frank, your quotation is, Mene, mene, teko ap asin.
I'm taking you back to England many, many centuries ago, back into the mists of time, considering the quotation, into Old Testament times. It wasn't called England then, of course. It was called Mesopotamia. And the people in the land weren't called English, they were called Angles, because they spent all their time fishing. and it's all about the English love of fishing, angling, in a book by Sir Isaac Walton called Walton on Thames, which was so popular that a small town was named after it. Now, the population was much smaller in Mesopotamia at that time, the Old Testament times. In fact, the population of what is now England was 93. And I'm concentrating your attention on one of those people. He was a juggler and prestidigitateur, which in those days was called a mimi, which makes a good name for him. The mimi were the entertainers. They sang, danced, juggled, did puppet shows, and which he did, in fact, and in London, which wasn't called London then, it was called Belgrade. He used to juggle and things, and used to sing comic songs, and he was the one who discovered this blue dye which you could paint your body with, and he painted it, he discovered it in the island of Thanet, which is the oldest part of Kent, and painting his body bright blue and singing his comic song was a terrific hit. He knocked them for six. He was the first comic singer to knock them in the old Kent word. And eventually, having performed to all the 93, he had to move abroad, and he went to France. He wasn't called France in those days. It was called Bury St. Edmunds. and he seemed that our little Mimi's life was going to be happy, but he got kidnapped by nasty tribesmen. They're terrible people, you know, infested Europe and the Middle East in those days. They used to have topless waitresses and all that, so they were called barbarians. And they sold him, our little Mimi, to the king of Babylon, whose name was Belshazzar. And Belshazzar was a rather nice old king, and he adopted. His name was Emmanuel Belshazzar. Did you know that? Very few people do. And our little Mimi was court jester to the king Belshazzar. And it was a very restive kingdom, because it was the time that the Medes were always bashing the Persians, and the Persians were bashing the Medes. And Belshazzar used to say to his little Mimi, court jester, he said, I can't tell one from the other. And the little Mimi said, well, you know, as the man said, one man's Mede is another man's Persian. And Belshazzar said, well, what can I do about it? And the little Mimi thought a bit and said, why don't you build them some houses? We all live in tents. Haven't you got a housing program? And he said, well, yes, I had. Yes, I did have a housing program, old Belshazzar. But they only built one house. That's my palace here. So little Mimi said, look, get them going. Tickle them up. Put a stick of dynamite under your housing people. And once we've all got mud hats instead of tents to live in, the Medes and the Persians will get on. And I'll be able to sleep better, because it's freezing cold at night in the tent here, you know, in Babylon. And Belshazzar said, at the feast tonight, I'll announce it. There they all were, and there was lovely music. It was in a Persian garden, played by a jazz pianist. Yeah, a Mede, Lux Lewis. He was playing away, and the king stood up and made his sort of opening of Parliament speech and told them all the good things he was going to do. You know, taking VAT off peacocks' tongues, and all asps exported to Egyptian queens had to have a government health warning with them. So, and he said, there's one other thing I'm going to do. My little Mimi told me to do it. There's something other I should do. And little Mimi said, he's forgotten what he's going to do. So he rushed and dipped his hand in some tomato juice left over from the feast and wrote on the wall, facing the king. He wrote this message on the wall, and the king said, there's a moving hand writing. What's he writ? I can't see without my glasses. And right across the hall, in Belshazzar's face, came the voice of the little English Mimi, reading out the writing of the wall. He said, "Manny, Manny, tickle up housing."
Thank you for that tale of ancient Babylon. Dennis, let's see how you can get on with Hoist with his own petard.
When all other ideas have deserted you, a highly experienced author told me recently, try writing about an eccentric relative. For a dead cert audience, please, he said, there is nothing to beat a balmy blood relation. At which I could only sigh and nod sadly. Because, you see, I'd just lost my own little gold mine. Because as any of you who listen to this half hour with any regularity may have spotted, an enormous number of my end-of-programme stories have been based on the sayings of my Aunt Alice, a lady given to utterances like, you can't judge someone's appearance just by looking at them. Or, no one goes to Margate anymore, it's too crowded. or on one momentous occasion, I think you'll find as you go through life that underneath every successful man is a woman. what she always had, you see, was a way of expressing herself or expressing her thoughts that left your mind with what I can only describe as skid marks. She'd come out with such off-centre sayings as, No, I didn't do as much as I expected to, dear, but then I never expected to. or the warning she gave my mother when my sister was having her first heavy romance. You've got to remember, a girl who is 17 is always much more of a woman than a boy of 17. Well, of course, that kind of thing is absolute grist to the my word mill. So every time I ran short of ideas, round I'd go to Aunt Alice's place with my little cassette recorder, and sure enough, up would come lines like, isn't there enough unhappiness on television without having it in real life? Or, it's better to be a big fish in a small bush than a little bird in a large pond. all of which I was able to employ so profitably that some years ago I became a little guilty about it. So next time I went round to Aunt Alice, I said to her, do you mind my habit of putting things that you say into a radio programme? To which she replied, do you do that, dear? I didn't know. And then, placing her frail little hand on mine, she said, but as long as it helps your career, of course I don't mind. Well, the way she said that was so sweet, it reminded me how she'd always been my favourite among my aunts, going right back to the day when she used to take my sister and I for outings to the National Gallery and say things like, if you're going to stop and look at everything, children, you won't see anything. So overcome by a great wave of affection, I said, look, dear, I tell you what, henceforth, every programme that I use a line of yours in, I'll pay you half my fee. And so from then on, not only did I feel happier about going round to her whenever I found myself stuck for something to work up into a my word story, but many of the lines she came out with seemed to be even better than before. You know, like the time she said, personally, dear, I think some of those pornographic novels are a bit risque. But as I've indicated, I already mentioned that whole arrangement is now a thing of the past because earlier this year, my cherished relative passed to where the honeysuckle no longer twineth. In other words, my favourite aunt became my favourite ex-aunt, or, as the Germans say, Alice is kaput. But it was only when, as her executor, I was obliged to go through her account book that I learnt just how much more eccentric she was than I even suspected, because when I came to 1975, which was the year when she'd started listing my payments to her, opposite all the neatly written little entries that were marked sale of lines to DN, there was another list of slightly smaller amounts which were marked purchase of lines from FM. In other words, what I'd been buying from her all those years were lines she'd been paying Frank Muir to write for. Well, can you think of a more humiliating position for a broadcaster to find himself in? As Shakespeare so eloquently put it, hoist by my own pet aunt.
Thank you, Dennis. Your aunt obviously knew the origin of royalty. Now, I've just been handed a sealed envelope that gives me this week's winners, and I, to raise the tension, I'll read it out in reverse order. The team to come in second this week is Antonia and Dennis. And our lucky winners are Dillis and Frank. And we hope you'll all join us again for our next programme. Until then, goodbye.